Welcome back, everybody. We heard last night about an Antarctic eclipse expedition, and now we're going to hear from Robert Chambora about a different Antarctic eclipse expedition.
Thank you. We're facing a good PR. I should say my name is Robert. My presentation is not quite 24 hours ago. Patrick Hanford, a pinch hitter, here, was not able to make it, and I am happily obliged. I was actually a bit disappointed that somebody wasn't going to be giving a presentation about the Antarctic eclipse that I saw, so I'm glad to hold a position. And I have to give a few credits. Fred Espenack, who helped me around midnight the bar last night, putting together my cover page and a couple of his pictures I used. And I also put together a few pictures from Fred Brunges, who I didn't know was going to be here. There was one of my partners in at the Novo station, and Roger Webb as well. So, interesting that on the cab on the way here yesterday, I was actually placing their photos into a presentation, not knowing that either one of them was going to be here. So, anyway. I need to switch to mine. Someone switch it back. There we go. I was planning on going on the icebreaker. And I think my story goes back quite briefly. In 1994, when I saw my first total solar eclipse. And deciding about 10 minutes after that I was going to aim to see everyone after that for the rest of my life, I quickly ran into a stumbling block walker in 2003 entitled Antarctica. So I realized I had 9 years to figure out how to tag on to someone's trip, which was going to be logistically very difficult, and also to probably have to save up a lot of money to make it. The icebreaker trip was about 28 days long. And I was going to do that. It was a bit long for me. And then I got a phone call one night from Vic Winter with Astronomical Tours. I said, Bob, I think I have a trip for you. We're going to be flying an Aleutian jetliner, which is kind of like a big C-130 Russian jet cargo plane. And we're going to land it on the ice at the Nova Lazarevskaya Research Station. Now, the good news is this is going to be about a 9 to 10 day trip. The bad news is the sun is going to be 1.5 degrees above the horizon, and the shadow will be moving in retrograde. So I thought, well, that sounds interesting. I don't think anyone's done that before. And 9 days was a bit more, 9-11 days was more appealing to me, so I decided to do that. So here's the path, which I'm sure is going to be shown here several times through the weekend. And there's our destination. Everyone shortens the name to the Novo station because Novo Lazarevskaya gets very long after you say it 50 times. And you can see that the eclipse takes place right near midnight local time and pretty much near what would usually be a sunset, although the sun's not setting at that time yet. This trip, which started at the beautiful and luxurious Caledon Hotel in Cape Town, was soon to be replete with a lot of difficulties and a lot of stumbling blocks. This trip for me, I think, in the word of eclipse chasing, this had to be one of the greatest pursuits to make this trip work out. All the way up to the last minute with one nail-biting experience after the next. We literally did not know that we were going to see the eclipse until probably moments before it happened. Our problem started, actually here's a map of here's how the plane flies in from Cape Town. It's only about a 6-hour flight from Cape Town. And you can see that Novo Lazarevskaya is actually a major jump-off station to a number of the other stations. Here's a picture of the airbase that we're supposed to be landing on. These pictures are taken from a presentation given to us in the hotel. Oh yeah, feel lights? Part of this presentation covered the dangers of crevasses, pretty much what crevasses are, and how to not go near them. For anyone who doesn't know what a crevasse is, it's a crack in the ice. Sometimes it can be miles deep. And if you fall down there, they just pretty much everyone just keeps going. And this was the first of three or four meetings that were full of bad news. Our original trip was designed that we would be at the Kalan Hotel over a period of 11 days. And we had a window of 3 days. And we could actually be on the ice for 72 hours, and we had a few days before and a few days after, depending on the weather, to make this work. Of course, it doesn't matter if there's 2 days later or 2 days early, as long as you're there during the time of the eclipse. First problem we had was, this is Robert Schroeder, who is our basically the director, the person directing the entire expedition, is giving us some bad news from the Nova Station, and that is that there is a major storm front that is pounding our base. Our base has been set up ahead of time. Usually the people that go down for Nova, other people that stay inside all year, which are just a few scientists, people that are at the base, don't go down until probably late November. They went down a week and a half, 2 weeks early in this case to help get set up for this expedition. At the moment, the people that are down there are getting pounded by a storm. 70 knot winds, 40 degrees below zero Fahrenheit with the wind chill. And in fact, it's so bad that everyone on the base has been ordered not to even leave their tent. Not even go to the mess tent, which in some cases was 50 feet away because of zero visibility. As a matter of fact, in a later meeting, there's actually four of these. There's only some purpose for one picture. In a later meeting, they told us that the situation has actually got worse, and indeed at the observation site that they've set up, that the toilets that they've set up, the portable toilets, have blown away. about half the tents are down on the campsite. And there's another storm that looks like it's heading right behind this one. But there is a ray of hope. And the hope is, it looks like there is a high pressure area that is embedded between these two nasty storms, and that may allow for a period of about 24 hours of at least weather that's good enough to land it. As you can see, here's our roughly where the Nova station is there. And this is I lifted this off the satellite. If anyone knows what an HPA is, Jay, I'm sure you know what that is, but the purple is over 400 HPA, which I take that to be bad. And you can see those things are right there. And there's actually two storm systems. There's wind blowing from two different directions. And there's our empty spot, and there's the storm coming in right behind it. This was our weather system. Again, there's our base getting pounded right there. There's a hopeful clear area, and there's a storm coming in right behind it. So it looks like we're going to have a very, very, not 3 days on the ice, but a very, very tight window of opportunity. While we're worrying about that, we come up with another problem, and some of us are realizing, especially with the help of Fred Goinges with his wonderful little Sony there, which I now have, it looks like our observation point may be off. From the direction that we're viewing the eclipse, the topography, it actually elevates under the horizon. And so now there's a question as to whether the sun is actually going to be a degree and a half above the horizon, or perhaps not even all the way above the horizon. So running a couple simulations, it looks like we may be looking at half of a solar disk. So not only worried about actually taking off and getting there, but worried if we actually get there, we're going to have a problem with the observation. So, a few nights at the bar, worrying over a couple cocktails, it's probably about the best way to spend your time. Trying to figure out alternate routes. Our site has been set up since most of it's blown away. Now we can actually look at maybe an alternate site, although we're literally down to hours before the eclipse. So, what do you do in times like this? You go out to eat, and you eat big lobsters. Had a wonderful night, a wonderful dinner the night before, our last-ditch effort to take off. We went to bed with Robert Schroeder telling us, be ready to leave at 4 a.m. if we're leaving at all. So the next morning, we got good news finally, after 3 days of waiting, and we figured that our latest possible time we could leave Lokofein was about 11 a.m. to possibly get there in time to see the eclipse. And in fact, it looked like our flight was going to leave around 7. So we were literally getting ready to take off with about 4 hours to spare. This is our first look at the Russian Ilyushin cargo plane. It's a beautiful plane. It's huge. It's definitely meant for cargo. That is the only window on the side of the plane. And that is the only way for passengers to get in and out. The inside is really funny. You don't think of it as like a 747, passenger jetliners, places for hangars. And you can see it's pretty sparse. It's very loud. Everyone was handed earplugs to get on the plane, and even with the doors closed, it is obnoxiously loud. My seat was right there, and I got the seat next to David and Wendy Levy. And right underneath a 2.5-ton of loading winch, which swung back and forth during our entire flight. Immediately in front of my seat is all the food. I felt like I was in the movie When Worlds Collide. People were just loading stuff up and getting ready to take off to a new world. Interesting plane where the navigation and the flight deck are on two different levels. The navigation is actually below, and this Russian plane, which I believe was built primarily as not like cargo but also as a bomber, you get to see your target below you. So we all had a chance to go up into the navigational pit here and to look down directly below you. Very interesting sensation if you're looking right down at your feet and seeing glaciers 30,000 feet down. In the plane, they actually set up an old-fashioned pull-down screen and a projector that was tied into a laptop and also a computer, which I hope was not being held by the pilot, but give us a good time, an idea of our flight time. Even to the point where we're halfway through our trip, we are still not positive we're going to be given permission to land. So there is a point of no return that we reach, and the point of no return came very close to the moment that we actually crossed over to the Antarctic Circle. So we've crossed over the point of no return and then into the Antarctic Circle, and we all realize that we're landing no matter what. The storm, by the way, was literally lifting at this moment. Hand out some champagne to celebrate the fact that we were actually going to land for sure. You can't see it here, but everyone's actually watching the screen as we land, as we're coming in for landing. You can actually see on the screen mountains and rock formations and glaciers and everything below you. There, it's actually coming into the runway here. This runway is 3,000 meters long, and I have to tell you, I think we used every meter. Obviously, you cannot brake, so they roll for quite some time, and then they reverse the engines toward the end. This is known as the Blue Ice Runway. So, we're on the ice. We finally get a chance to hop out. You have to kind of walk around like a penguin because it is very slick. That blue ice is pretty slippery. Here's a view of the base from the air. It was taken later. It's hard to tell here, but this entire area of the base used to look like this part of the base. Quite a bit in ruins. This is the very, very old part of the Nova station. And there's our plane. The red tents are from the NHK Japanese researchers that were at the same site. There were about 66 of us on our trip, and I think there were over 200 Japanese that were there. And they had their smaller jet that they were going to watch the eclipse from the air and from the ground simultaneously. So after we get acclimated, and it's not too cold here, it looks like it, but it's actually about probably minus 5 Celsius. This was Ilka. Ilka was one of those poor people that were stuck in the tent during these 60-70 knot winds. And a lot of us on the trip were quite concerned about the people down there. We said, is there anything we can do for them, anything that they need? And the answer that was radioed back from Elka was, we are out of whiskey. So she is holding in her hand a few gifts of some good single malts. Here's a good view of the plane. And this nice observational pic. One of the problems that started before our trip goes all the way back to February of 2003. Jen Hughes, one of the astronomical tours, took a site inspection trip down. And on the trip down, they actually loaded one fuel bladder. Now, the plane just can't go down there, land, and turn around and fly back. And it does not have, it can't even take all its own fuel. So even with a couple passengers, it was able to fly down one fuel bladder. It needs two fuel bladders for each flight on the way down, on the way back. So one fuel bladder was flown, for the return flight, one fuel bladder was flown down on the site inspection trip back in February. And in the later spring 2003, the second fuel bladder was actually shipped down on an infamous icebreaker called the Magdalena Ohlensdorf. Now, if anyone remembers the Magdalena Ohlensdorf, that was the ship that actually got stuck in the ice and all of its crew had to be rescued. And then the ship was basically left on the ice till the following year. But luckily, the Magdalena Ohlensdorf had got our second fuel bladder down to the ice shelf and actually got stuck on its return. The problem was when the team went down to open up the campsite, and we found out about this while we were in Africa, it turns out that the second fuel bladder that was delivered by the Magdalena Ohlensdorf was set on the side of an ice shelf, and that during the year, the ice shelf had collapsed, and that our second fuel bladder was now 1,200 feet below the ocean, which meant we were short one fuel bladder. While we were in Africa, they negotiated with the Maitri station, which is the Indian station that is right near the Novorossiysk station, and we bargained. They bartered one fuel bladder for a bunch of extra supplies. The fun part of this exchange was finding out that a lot of the equipment that we had all painstakingly set up, we'd all set up our procedure, the different equipment we were to bring, and we were told that you now get to take this bag and one carry-on. Everything else stays here. And that was exchanged for all the extra supplies that the Maitri station needed. So here is the Maitri tractor. And the first fuel bladder being delivered by the Indians to immediately refuel our plane on the landing. Also at the station, they have two Russian biplanes. Very neat. They're actually they each seat about 10 people, and they fly together. If one's broken, they don't fly the second one. And we make our way to the Novo camp. There's the NHK with their big satellite. This is the hangar for the biplanes. This was one of the tents we were supposed to be sleeping in. And there are some of the other tents we were supposed to be sleeping in. But the portable potties are back behind this hill somewhere. So, hurdle number 17, as we're getting ready to go to the eclipse site with literally hours left, we're all told that sleeping accommodations are changing, and there's not a place for us all to sleep. So the choices got down pretty quickly between being on the plane or sleeping inside this airplane hangar. So believe it or not, about 50 of us fit inside that airplane hangar, and literally, kind of a blurry picture, set of cots, and that is basically solid ice with a plastic tarp over the top of it, and cots, and you just sleep in your hair if you sleep at all. So, we're now down to hours. At this point in time right here, I believe we have 3 hours before first contact. So we catch a quick bite to eat in the mess tent, and we load up on this this tractor truck of sorts, and we shove off. being friends with David Levy and Vic Winters had its advantages. I got to stay up in the cab where it was nice and warm as opposed to back in the coal truck. Now we arrive at what is supposed to be our observation site. And by the time we arrive there, this is roughly what the sun looks like. We're running very far behind. At this point in time, people are pretty much giving up on partial phase shots. And what's more bothersome is that right there. And the sun is getting low. And there's a hill right in front of it. So we're now getting concerned that from our observation site, the place that we're standing at, that we're going to see half of the disk. Now, I do have to point out some good news here. And the good news is we are in a high-pressure area, and there is not a cloud in the sky. And there's very little particulate matter. There's zero humidity. At this point in time, there's very little wind. And other than a little bit of convection, which you can see on the horizon, it is a crystal clear day. So as far as clouds, you could not have asked for better weather in Antarctica. So we decide, looking on the horizon, looking for, we try to find a better observation point, and one that we cannot drive to, but one we have to walk to. So walking toward the sun does not make any sense because we're actually walking closer to where this hill is. And moving east and west, as it were, doesn't have any advantages. So the only thing that's left for us is to walk what is north. And we're told that they're pretty sure that there aren't too many crevasses in that direction. So with the sun getting, you can see how low the sun is at this point. Fred Bridges and Vic Winter and Jen Winter, Dr. Levy, Wendy Levy, and a few others, we all decide to walk north to what we think is a light spot on the snow on the horizon. We couldn't tell whether it was a mile away or several hundred meters away, and actually seeing one of the planes coming in to land to bring in the observers. It went through the sunlight, and we were able to determine that it wasn't far enough away that we could probably make it. So we started hiking off in that direction, and probably about halfway, this shot, we turned around and took a picture, and you can see we're leaving our group behind here. By the time we actually found our observation site, we were probably about 2 kilometers away from the rest of the group. And now we're ready to set up our equipment. And that's what the sun looks like at that moment. So not only had most of us completely rewritten our plans, photo shooting camera plans, but we're rewriting it again. Because we have very little time to spare. So we're shy on equipment, shy on time. And even at this moment, with probably 5 to 10 minutes before second contact, the last biplane is flying in the last observers. You can see the color on the horizon.
Wow.
Jan Winter wrote in a little synopsis of her story that the snow was the color of cotton candy pinks and cotton candy blues. I couldn't agree more. That was exactly what it looked like. Temperature now is below 0 Fahrenheit. And I'm switching back and forth from one glove to the other. And I can already feel the frostbite, but that's okay. Sacrifices have to be made. This is a nice fisheye. It was done by Vic Winter. And you can see about how far we are away from the horizon. There's where some of the other observers are. And I think it's off to the right. There's actually, you can actually see the plane on the horizon. You have to understand that most of our equipment was now failing. Not just from cold batteries, but just from cold digital equipment altogether. So interesting how we all had the Nikon D100s and digital camcorders. And the tried and true 35mm Nikon 6006s or Pentaxes or whatever were what ended up saving the day. I would say, out of all of us that were in this little row here, I would say that all of us put together 2/3 to 3/4 of our camera equipment failed.
Cool.
So there are some pictures that were where cameras were grabbed very quickly that were not meant to take these pictures. They were meant to take wide fields, but being mounted. And we actually were ripping them off the tripod and just taking handheld shots just to at least get pictures of the shadow.
Oh, wow.
Here's an amazing picture taken by another friend, Bunges. I don't think there'll be many times where you can take a picture of an eclipse and there's a person a kilometer ahead of you that's standing in front of the desk. Now, this is interesting. This is not too far into second contact. And you can see the dust from the plane that's just landed. So we had about 80% of a disc. Another photo from Fred Bunges. Marvelous fisheye taken by Vic Winter. And then it's over. It's carrying that wheel of thought. I have to say, the light dynamic of this eclipse was beyond any eclipse I've seen. The feeling of the shadow moving directly, horizontal to, moving left to right, and moving so fast, the moon moving in retrograde, the speed of the shadow is, I think where we were figured it was like 4,000 kilometers an hour. It's very quick. And so now I realize that we're among the few that have actually are the first ones to see a total solar eclipse in Antarctica. Immediately after, David Levy made a satellite phone call to the Discover Canada to give a quick interview. In the United States, nobody could quite get past the news of Michael Jackson being indicted, so the eclipse was kind of overshadowed. And those are the only technicals I have for you. These are from, whoops. Well, that's interesting. I didn't do that before.
That's a very good thing.
Minus 35 degrees Fahrenheit with the wind chill, third contact. Now, everybody was giving a lot of credit to a lot of smart people, the luck of the storm system, the skill of the Russian pilots, but in reality, the only reason we saw this eclipse is because my daughter made me bring her lucky astronaut and her lucky pig with me. I had some time to have fun with these Russian biplanes, which I'll run through quickly here. The sights there are just stunning. I mean, everything's pristine, untouched. The mountains are spectacular. And pretty much all of us had a chance to take a flight on the biplane. We landed about 100 kilometers away from the Nova Station at a glacier bed. And as always, it's a wonderful feeling to think you're walking someplace that no one's walked before. We had a 1980 British Olympic contender, and except they pulled out of the Olympics, so we didn't get a chance to compete. But I got a fencing lesson, as did some others. We had a violin recital, a little dancing. Now, this is a blurry picture, but if you look close, you can even see her goosebumps here. And I think that that's Carol playing the violin, and that look on her face, I think the cold's getting to her fingers there. One last look at the Blue Ice Runway. And there's our Team Novo. And our traditional celebratory Cuban Havana back to Cape Town. And that's it.
Thank you.
successful expedition. Are there any questions? When the plane was landing, and the rocket was pink, that should have been during Coast Holiday. I don't think that was before. Because then you showed a picture with Blue Sky after that. So I bet that was during Coast Holiday.
I wasn't watching the planes right then.
Yeah. If anybody wants to see 8200 biplanes like that Tiger Moss, they're up at Woburn this weekend, in a big field.
Yes?
I'm just wondering what the penguins did.
There were actually no penguins near us. Unfortunately, I would love to have done. There was one that supposedly roamed around the base, but we didn't see him, and we weren't near the base.
There are still photographs by an NHK photographer on the internet that actually showed the eclipse sun about one solar diameter above the horizon. Where did they go? Where you couldn't go?
The airplane.
No, but I think they were ground phase pictures.
Yeah, they were on a high hill that we didn't have clearance to go on.
Uh-huh. That's right. As a matter of fact, somebody actually got injured on that hill, if I remember right.
Yeah.
Somebody had actually fallen off and they had to be airlifted. Mm-hmm. It was a nasty big rock.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually drove around it, and they had found their way up this hill.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they had already figured out that they wanted to get a little bit higher.
Mm-hmm.
But crevasses all over the place. So we were not clear to go there, and I don't regret going there.
Mm-hmm.
How many people here were on this expedition? Three of you.
Mm-hmm.
And in completing the sentence, were there anybody else who saw this from some other location and I haven't asked about yet? Okay. One more question?
Yes. Jen was commenting by email on a green card he's got. Did you have any comments on that?
There was an interesting green hue, especially behind us. And I tell you what, the sky was unbelievable colors all the way around. And because of the shadow being so low on the horizon, like, there were different colors I had not seen before. And they were all the way around. We really didn't see any dark blue or dark gray patches. One thing we were watching for, something we were hoping for, is that immediately before this eclipse, there was a lot of solar activity, and we were hoping to see some aurora australis. So we all took a quick glance, and no one saw anything. Those things just tilted the light.
Anyway, that's really fabulous. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Both mentioned Vic and Jen Winter, who organized this trip and who also organized the Captain Klebnikov, or a large aspect of the Captain Klebnikov. She has organized two ships to the 2005 hybrid eclipse. Len is going to be on one out of Tahiti, and Fred Espenak and I are going to be at one out of Galapagos. So we hope that she's as successful with that as she was with this very tricky expedition to Antarctica, and we'd obviously be glad to talk to any of you.
And if you call her and book yourself and mention her names, they'll be sure to make sure we get discounts.